Director Gibson? Director Rapoport?
Here.
Vice President Austin?
Here.
President White?
Here. We all stand for the flag salute, please. Attention, salute.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay. Has everybody read the agenda?
Can you please pull the microphone down?
Oh, sorry. Jeez. Can we now have, can we have the agenda review? Any changes, modifications, amendments?
President White, members of the board, we have provided the handout for item 8C. It is a breakdown of each person on page 7 of your agenda. So it's basically just listing out every person, and it ties back to page 17. So there's no adjustments in our recommendations. It's just a supplemental handout.
Thank you very much. Entertain a motion.
I move that we approve the agenda as presented.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Carries 3-0, 1 absent. Moving on to closed session.
Okay, seeing no public for public comment, we'll move to closed session pursuant to Government Code Section 54956.9D4. Conference with District Legal Counsel regarding anticipated litigation. There is one matter.
Thank you. We'll go on to closed session. Okay. Call a meeting back to order of the Oceana Community Service District Board of Directors regular meeting for Wednesday, September 26th. Moving on, closed session. Is there any report from closed session?
The report out of closed session is no reportable action.
Thank you. Now I'll move to public comment for items not on the agenda. Public comment period provides the opportunity for members of the public to address the board on matters of interest within the jurisdiction of the district that are not listed on the agenda. We ask that people limit their comments to 3 minutes. And I see no one coming forward. So we'll move on to special presentations and reports, staff reports, starting with Tony Maraschino, field supervisor.
Good evening, board. Tony Maraschino. Actually, I didn't have time to fill out paperwork this afternoon. We've been on a line that was leaking on 24th Street at polybutylene, and with polybutylene, it's a flexible line. So instead of it being a direct line from the main to the meter, we had to actually open up the main about 11 feet to locate how it was tied into the main. So we were been on it quite a bit this week, and we also have another line that's leaking currently in Arroyo Grande's city limits that we'll be going to next. Just really staying busy with sewer cleaning, meter changeouts, coordination with the Air Park Bridge, because we'll be starting that here within the next 2 weeks. 2 to 3 weeks, we'll be over there starting that project. A lot of coordination, you know, melodrama. They're just staying busy. So I will give you a better update next go around. We got out of work a little bit late today.
Yes.
So.
Thank you very much for digging out those lines.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Do you have to do that with a shovel, or can you do that with a backhoe?
Actually, this one was a little bit of everything, because there was a sewer lateral, there was a 3/4-inch gas line, there was a 2-inch gas transmission line involved. Second 3/4-inch gas line, so we got to vacuum, backhoe, and hand dig. Once you get it within about 2 feet of the utility, you start hand digging.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm sure you do.
And then also, you don't want to break the existing water line that's currently leaking. So you just don't want to shut the customer off until the last minute where you can change over the new line to the old line. So you let it leak so they still have water. because it might take a few hours. You don't want to inconvenience them as much as possible, as least as possible.
And you had to replace the whole line? You couldn't patch?
No, polybutylene is a product that no longer exists. They stopped selling it, and it's just really bad stuff. That mostly is what's blowing apart in our system, that and old galvanized lines.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no way to patch it.
What is it, one-inch line?
What's that?
Was it a one-inch line, two-inch
line? Yeah, it's a one-inch line from the main going to the meter.
Yeah. Yes. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, that's right up the street from my place. I saw the water bubbling up on Sunday. What caused it to leak? Did it crack over time?
Polybutylene, it's about 15 to 20 years old, and it is a flexible blue line. And then when they put these sleeve inserts, they're little metal, as they put them in to connect them to the angle stops or any kind of thing that bolts up to them, how it bends, that little sleeve, when the water turns on and off in your house, it'll cause a water hammer. So it moves a little bit, and that sleeve actually cuts the pipe. It's a real thin, flexible blue pipe. I'll actually bring some in next board meeting.
Well, show and tell.
So you can see how it tears apart right there.
Yeah, it's just a bad design.
Really bad design. And they got rid of it probably in the 90s. But they do not produce it, nothing. Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. General Manager, Mr. Ogren.
President White, members of the board, a few items to update you on. One is that Vice President Austin and I did meet with County Supervisor Compton on Monday and covered a couple of items, including gave her an update on the Five Cities Fire Authority discussions, because last week we met with the county team that's working on the special district component of the CAL FIRE County strategic plan. And that went well, and so gave Supervisor Compton that feedback. Also requested a greater level of coordination on code enforcement issues. And she got Art Trinidad on the phone as we were meeting. And I will be meeting with him on a monthly basis in order to review status on code enforcement issues as a start. What we're really seeking is greater ongoing coordination, that if they have a code enforcement issue and if we have a similar code enforcement issue on the same property, we really want to be able to coordinate those efforts, and especially timing, even if we have to maintain some independence. We want to. So initially, though, I'll be meeting with Art Trinidad on a monthly basis. I'm going to target the fourth Wednesday of the month in the morning so that I can give your board updates at that evening's meeting then. And then we also discussed the place and the desire to establish some informal review with county planning on what it might take in order to be able to use the old fire station for alternative purposes. Secondly, I want to remind everybody that on Saturday, November 17th, we will be having an open house at the Community Center in Oceano Elementary School. We've been doing some of our coordination meetings. I want to make sure to thank Nicole on those efforts, because we had one of our first participant coordination meetings today, and she led that whole discussion, and appreciate the work efforts that she's doing leading up to the open house. And then third, and I anticipate this will be on for greater discussion at the next agenda, there was an interesting and really probably pretty far-reaching appeals court decision. And, of course, since it's the appeals court, we'll see whether it goes to the state Supreme Court or not. But the basic determination or the basic ruling is that counties have a duty with respect to public trust in issuing new well permits. Recently there was a case resolved that the County of San Luis Obispo does not have to go through CEQA in issuing new well permits because the county has taken a ministerial approach on issuing those permits. But this is sort of completely independent. And if the court's ruling stands that the county has a public trust doctrine issue, it's going to be significant. And because historically, the issue is that in the issuance of permits for people to pump groundwater, that in California, if there's groundwater problems, then that's an adjudication. And even more recently, with the establishment of the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, that's a management plan. Those are all kind of treated independently. But now that counties appear to be handed the responsibility or the duty for public trust, it's another issue associated with water rights that could really change the game, because it becomes a responsibility then. And our farming community right here on Arroyo Grande Creek should really consider this as being an at-risk item, because we already know that the evidence exists that sometimes when the farmers are pumping, the creek goes dry. And with endangered species in the creek, you know, then it points to public trust doctrine issues and what kind of responsibilities might the county have in the future to ensure that the pumping operations don't cause the creek to go dry, at least not to the detriment or damage to endangered species and other public trust issues. But the endangered species and the habitat is by far the most significant public trust issue, especially in Arroyo Grande Creek. And so it could be really a significant game changer in terms of the county's duties and responsibilities. The case specifically was addressing new well permits, but of course speculation as to what kind of ongoing responsibilities they might have. And then to the district specifically, how might it impact the habitat conservation plan that's being developed and county responsibilities associated with the habitat conservation plan? So that I want to be able to get on the agenda next meeting, because it also influences things like how are we approaching the low reservoir response plan and other permanent contract amendments that we might be seeking.
Thank you.
And that concludes my report. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Question?
I don't have any.
None here. Well, we can move on to Board of Directors and Outside Committee reports. And start with
Cynthia. I had no meetings since the last meeting, unless you want me to talk about the Oceano Advisory Committee.
If you want to.
Council.
Yeah. We had that yesterday.
Monday,
yeah. So there were a couple of permit issues that came before the OAC. One was for another non-storefront retail cannabis delivery service. This one on Railroad Street over by the Senior Center. There was some concerns raised about traffic in that area and also the fact that it seems like we might be getting a lot of these types of businesses here, so some questions are being submitted to the county about that. The other one was for a 10 by 20 foot recycle bin on Front Street right next to La Tapatia. And the Oceano Beach Community Association and also Robin from Tierra Nueva raised a concern about the location of that being so close to the downtown area and where the revitalization plan is proposing a pedestrian plaza. But aside from that, there weren't any major concerns raised on that one. So looks like it's going to go forward. We also discussed California State Parks plans for music festivals, one or two music festivals between October and February. And a letter is going to be written about that, just raising some concerns that the community be considered regarding traffic and any impacts on emergency services and so forth. And also, we changed the day and time of the meetings. They're now going to be on the third Thursday of every month at 5:30. So this will allow some of the members who weren't able to attend during working hours to be able to come to that meeting, and also hopefully more members of the public who work during the day will be able to attend. I think that was it.
That's it, yeah. Very good. Yep. Okay. Vice President Austin?
I attended the South San Luis Obispo County Sanitation District meeting, and pretty routine. We did have two notices of completion. One was the valve replacement project, that the four valves that operate the digester needed to be replaced, and then the digester rehabilitation project was completed, which was really a big step. And I was able to get to the plant and see all the completion of the digester project, and it looks very good. I think things are running very well over at the plant right now. That's about it for this time.
Okay, and I attended Five Cities Fire Authority monthly meeting, and the major thing is there's a delay, but the dispatching services for the Five City Fire Authority will start coming from Cal Fire in November, and I was somewhat concerned about the changes. Right now they're dispatched, Oceano and Grover are dispatched by Grover Beach. And I was somewhat concerned about it, but I was relieved to find out there will be an improvement actually for Oceano. Because automatically, if somebody, either whether they get to the sheriff's office or to 911 calls either go to the sheriff's office or the CHP from Oceano, depending on where you might be standing. If you're on Highway 1, it's going to go to CHP. Other areas would be the sheriff's office. And then there's a delay. Sometimes then they were kicked over to Cal Fire, and then they were finally kicked over to Grover. But the new system, no matter whether it's the sheriff or CHP, when they hear fire, they will automatically kick it into the Cal Fire dispatch system, which will dispatch everybody. And there's an improvement on how all the units, depending on whether it's Five Cities or Cal Fire or from Pismo or who it is, there will be also an improvement in them being able to talk to each other directly. And there will also be a CAD, a full CAD system, which will map and show exactly where the fires are. And actually, we'll have some improved programs on telling the fire guys which streets to take to get there fastest. So I think it really will benefit Oceano, where in the past we've had calls that went to Cal Fire. I mean, they went to CHP, then to Cal Fire, then to Grover Beach Dispatch, and even a minute or 2 minutes in making all those call shifts. So I think it's good for us, and that was a major thing. There's a little change in cost, but that's covered in the Five Cities Fire Authority budget that we already have. So there won't be any additional cost directly to, right?
Where okay. Is the Cal Fire Dispatch Center?
Cal Fire Dispatch Center will be in San Luis Obispo, but it'll be for almost everybody's going to be on it now except the city of San Luis Obispo, which is still trying to decide whether they want to go. But all the other agencies would be Napomo, Pismo, all of five. So all of the five cities will be on one system. And I really was concerned about it, but I think it will be better. I wasn't satisfied, but I think I am now. Thank you. Okay, we need to call for public comment on any of the staff or board of director reports. Seeing nobody come forward, we'll move on to consent items. Is that agenda? Do we need a report on that?
No, just public comment, and then if board members have any questions.
Okay. Call for public comment on the consent agenda. That's the minutes for September 12th, cash disbursements and write-offs of utility bills and customer credits for 3 years or over. Seeing no one come forward, move it to the board. Do we have any questions, comments?
No, I don't have any.
No.
So I'll make a motion. We approve the consent agenda as presented.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Carries 3-0 with one absent. That's going along quickly. Now we're going to slow it down. Business items, I will call for public comment on the 4 business items. Seeing no one come forward, I would like to move to 9A, the appointment to fill a vacancy on the Board of Directors.
Madam President, members of the board, we have only one individual who has inquired and interested in the appointment, unless others have shown up to the meeting, and that is Aileen Villa, who also will be appointed by the Board of Supervisors on November 6th, the day of the general election. And so if your board so chooses today, appointing Aileen to the board will then cover the period of time from today's meeting through December, when she would otherwise be appointed.
Yes. I would be proud to make a motion that we appoint Aileen Villa to the Board of Directors of the Oceana Community Service District for a term of 2 months. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Second, it's been moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Carries 3-0.
And so at this time,
Ms. Villa,
then,
would you please come forward?
To the podium. And this is for your swearing in. So repeat after me. I, and then state your name.
I, Aileen Villa.
Do solemnly swear.
Do solemnly swear.
That I will support and defend.
That I will support and defend.
The Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the State of California.
The Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the State of California.
Against all enemies.
Against all enemies.
Foreign and domestic.
Foreign and domestic.
That I will bear true faith and allegiance.
That I will bear true faith and allegiance.
To the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the State of California.
To the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the State of California.
That I take this obligation freely.
That I take this obligation freely.
Without any mental reservation.
Without any mental reservation.
Or purpose of evasion.
Or purpose of evasion.
That I will well and faithfully discharge.
That I will well and faithfully discharge.
The duties upon which I am about to enter.
The duties upon which I'm about to enter.
That's it. Congratulations, Aileen.
Can I say a few words now?
Sure.
Well, appropriately on the chair next to Karen White.
Okay. I'll try to be clear and succinct. I'm very honored as a lifelong resident of Oceano to take my position. I hope to do my best. And I will need help, so I will reach out, and hopefully you'll be patient with me. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Join us, and we're moving to item 9B, which is discussion on the lease with Lucy Amar Unified School District for the Oceana Community Center and board direction as deemed appropriate.
Madam President, members of the board, this item is on the agenda today, essentially at the request of Director Raplogle, and in the addendum to the material, there's the entire lease agreement. In the staff report itself, I identified the specific term, which is that the district, by agreement with Lucy Amar Unified School District, has the use of the community center for up to 120 hours per year, or basically about 10 hours per month. And We, as previously mentioned, we will be using it for around 4 or 5 hours on November 17th, but historically, you know, we don't utilize the community center very much. And I think that maybe Director Replogle wanted to speak to some recreational options or some other thoughts as a general discussion.
Yeah, I know we have some community groups that are interested in perhaps holding recreational activities for the children of Oceano at no or low cost, and they would like to take advantage of those hours that the OCSD has not been using. So I would like to open a discussion as to how we could coordinate that for providing additional recreation opportunities for the community.
So the idea is that it's one of the nonprofits or other groups within the community which would do something underneath the hours that were currently permitted.
Yes.
Okay. I think two things that we need to do is, first, I would look for a recommendation from the board or a motion from the board to have President White correspond with David Church, who's the executive director of the Local Agency Formation Commission. And the basic purpose of the letter is to indicate that it's your board's position that you do actually have current active recreation powers. Historically, we have spoken with, in the context of, and LAFCO has as well, that our recreational powers are currently latent. And I think when, you know, upon further review of the agreement with Lucia Marr School District, I think that was probably a historical error. The idea is we have a lease agreement with Lucia Marr. They're specifically obligated to provide recreational services. And via that lease agreement, it is a power that the district has implemented, even if it is delegated or assigned or, you know, it's being implemented by Lucia Marr. And the importance of corresponding with LAFCO on that point is that if it's the converse, if LAFCO continue to take the position that our recreational powers are latent, in order to be able to activate them, we have to go through an entire LAFCO hearing process. And so what I think we would do is seek to avoid that hearing process, notice LAFCO that it's the board's position, and if Executive Director Church needed to put an item on their agenda just or on, you know, make a notice or something, that might be appropriate. But again, I think it's important for your board to take the position that, in fact, our powers are not latent, but there are an active power through the agreement. Given that, then, the second step would be to simply put out a request for proposals for organizations to propose on doing some recreational programs. We would then gather those proposals, bring them back to your board, and we would have to coordinate with Lucia Marr as well, because one of the provisions in the agreement is we have to work around their schedule somewhat. You know, it's basketball season, so, you know, on Saturdays when the kids are there, it's going to be a lot of basketball. So we have to be able to coordinate with their schedules. But again, the two motions that I would be seeking from your board is, one is authorizing the president to work with LAFCO, and that the board's position is that recreation is an active power. And then the second is that after we've gotten confirmation or gone through LAFCO, is to have a RFP out on the street so that, you know, different nonprofits or community organizations can make proposals to the district, and then those would come back to your board for review.
Okay. So the first one, I'll make a motion that we authorize the president to write the letter to LAFCO stating that we have this recreational powers to look into that.
That they are an active power.
That they are an active power. And our position is we want it to be an active power.
Right.
And then...
And that would be the first motion.
The first, yeah.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Carries 4-0. 1 absent.
And then the second one is...
I will move that after we receive confirmation from LAFCO that we have active powers in the recreation area, that we solicit proposals from local organizations to use the hours that we have available at the community center and coordinate with LUCMR.
Second. It's been moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Carries 4-0, 1 absent. I just had one question after the vote. When Oceana Community Services District bought that property, I'm looking at 2000.
The year 2000?
I think that's when.
Yeah, the property was donated via, it was first fish and game property donated to the county. County turned around and donated it, as well as a whole bunch of community development block grant money and other funding in order to construct a community center.
But before that, Oceana Community Service District already owned the property.
Before the construction agreement came together, yeah. My review of the files had indicated that the property came via a grant.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it's that grant that has the condition that it needs to, in perpetuity, it has to be used for recreational purposes.
Yeah, I was just wondering if that came before or at the timing was in relationship to the Oceana Community Service District, if it came about the same time the district was formed or...
Oh, the district's formation? No, well, the district was formed in 81, so it came.
No, okay, that.
Yeah,
never
it came
mind.
Subsequent.
Never mind, my question's mute. Moot. Excuse me. Moot. Mute. Should be mute. Okay. Any other comments or questions on this?
No, thank you for checking into that, Ms. Trogan.
Moving to item C, introduction of the district's draft standard construction contract and the draft general conditions for board discussion and approval at a subsequent meeting for informal bids.
Yes, President White, members of the board. So the two documents that I've worked on with legal counsel, I have a PowerPoint. I won't delve into too much of the details because I think on a combined basis, it's almost 100 pages of contract-related documents. So I'm going to do a real sort of summary presentation. And we have had a little bit of technical difficulties here, so we'll hope that we're going to keep it together. So as part of the addendum is the draft construction contract. And what's important about these documents is that the district hasn't really put out a project out to bid in, you know, really quite some time. And so we have to start building our contract documents or our construction documents. And so the first is the actual draft construction contract. And then attached to construction contracts are a whole myriad of different exhibits, and it can depend on the different types of projects. Is it federally funded? If it's federally funded, then we're going to have federal requirements in construction contract documents as well. But the exhibits include general conditions, and so we have the draft general conditions. And essentially, the construction contract and the general conditions are the two standard documents that apply to all construction projects, or most all construction projects. And then as I get into it, there are a whole bunch of other exhibits that are really project-specific. And so attached to a construction contract and all the exhibits are, well, it's first the notice inviting bids, because there's all sorts of public contract code requirements on how we even advertise to bids. And then the contractor's bid, because whatever a whoever the selected contractor is, their bid is binding, and so that gets attached. Exhibit C is the general conditions. And so that's the second document that we're going to be talking about today. And what's a little bit unique, or a point to be discussed here, is that the general conditions, it's really a historical practice, and it's really a practice prior to the invention of computers. Because as you can imagine, with a lot of details in construction contracts, the approach was you establish general conditions, And then you work on how do we change those general conditions on any specific project that we might want to implement. So it's our general approach to contracts. And then here is the illustration of Exhibit D, which we won't be discussing today because that's all is project specific, is where you develop your special provisions. And those special provisions then might modify your general conditions. Well, in today's world of computers, we go, well, why do we do that? You know, just modify the general conditions and you know, it's not that big of a deal. And we don't make that change. It's because the contracting industry, in part, is used to this approach. So once they read an agency's general conditions, they know that when they go to bid on a project, they already know what our general conditions are. They just focus in on special provisions, technical provisions, plans, and specs in order to be able to study what we're asking for. And so, if we have a modification to general conditions, then we'll list those in the special provisions. And the industry is used to that approach. And essentially, even though we have computers, it makes their job more efficient by not changing the general conditions on every single project. So Exhibit D, again, gets into special provisions. A lot of those will be modifications to general conditions and or technical specifications is really when you're then getting into the details of what are you constructing and how do you want to go about constructing it. Exhibit A, E is payment and performance bonds, all construction contracts. Contractors have to essentially get insurance companies in order to underwrite their projects that if they fail to perform, and then payment is if they fail to pay their subcontractors. But payment and performance bonds together, then payment being money side, performance is work side. Essentially, insurance companies guarantee their work. And during the recession that we had, there was a number of subdivisions where the developers were failing and going bankrupt. And so in my prior employment, those performance bonds, we had to call a lot on them. And it's not easy to get an insurance company to pay up, but it happens. And in the recession, it happened quite often. Exhibit F is our insurance requirements. And those are standard insurance requirements. And so legal counsel and I are reviewing some from other agencies, and we'll come back with recommendations when we're ready to get the contract the construction contract and the general conditions finaled. And then Exhibit G is sort of that catch-all, all other types of things if applicable. So I mentioned federal funded projects. Exhibit G, we would be incorporating federal requirements. There's a number of them where you have to sign off and make attestations and different things like that. So that's the general approach to construction contracts is you have the contract itself and then a number of different exhibits that obviously relate to either the bidding process, technical provisions, plans and specs, insurance, and then other types of requirements. Just kind of running through here without intending to delve into any great level of detail, this is the construction contract table of contents. And I will back up or pause for a second and say, well, we didn't reinvent the wheel here. I did an internet search, and the City of Santa Monica's documents are the ones that we're boilerplating after. They did pretty significant revisions in 2017. I talked to their staff on the phone. They're in a constant process of updating their construction documents and their general conditions, especially as the law changes. But I just, you know, having reviewed a lot of different construction contracts over the course of my career, when I found theirs and I was reading through it, it was very well written. So that's what we're boilerplating after. Now, the only one in here that I highlighted and read to sort of speak to specifically is called the contract documents. And so I went through the general outline on the previous slide, but contract documents can get extremely voluminous. You can include geotechnical reports in there. You can include surveyor reports in there. And the idea is in more complicated construction projects, you include all of the other work of the professionals, like the geotechnical report, because if they're part of contract documents, then the contractor is obligated to understand them. And so you're switching a burden of responsibility from the district to the contractor. And even in some situations where we provide them contract documents, maybe again on geotechnical, we can provide them the responsibility to do additional explorations if they find it necessary. So it's a way of protecting a district. We give them the best available information that we have, and sometimes we want to incorporate those technical studies into contract documents to make sure that they have the burden to review and understand and to point out any flaws they might see in them. A lot of the other provisions are really risk-related provisions. What are all the different things that might go wrong in a construction contract, and what are we going to do about them? And it's important to note, because there is always the general perception out there that they gave us a bid, they got to get the job done, and they got to get it done within the price of the bid. And the answer is, well, no, that's not necessarily so. What they did is they bid on a job based on the construction documents that they were handed. And if there's any variances, then we got to talk about whose responsibility is it. You know, is it going to create additional costs that the district would be liable for? Maybe there's an error in omission by an engineering firm, and the engineering firm is going to, the contractor gets compensated, but we might have recourse against the engineering firm. Just because there's an error in omission in a design document doesn't mean that the designer is liable, though. If it's an error in omission that would have otherwise been required to build, like let's say they forgot to specify concrete on a sidewalk, and everybody goes, well, of course there has to be concrete on a sidewalk. That's something that the district would have already had to pay, so we're still going to have to pay it. But if there's an error in omission that causes work to be redone, that you know, go down a path, we build something, we find an error, so something has to be torn down and redone, well, that type of thing, very much the designer is at risk for having to pay if there's rework. The point here is that there's all sorts of different things. Another common thing is underground conditions. If you start working underground and you find things that you didn't know were there, let's say that it was an area where there was an old oil tank and nobody knew that that oil tank was there. Well, the contractor's not going to be liable for that type of unforeseen condition. But the details in these different provisions are really important because, again, just like a design error or omission, the designer's not necessarily liable. If a contractor finds an unforeseen condition or something goes up, they don't necessarily have a right to additional compensation, and they don't necessarily have a right to additional time in order to do the work. So these documents are, you know, they're pretty standard industry documents, and one of the things that I liked about City of Santa Monica documents and going to contract training classes where you're, you know, listening to the attorneys talking about different examples, and then they turn around and they say, so in your document, you want to make sure to include this kind of language. And so there's no contract that's perfect, but again, boilerplating after the City of Santa Monica's, I think, was a really good approach. Section 20 talks of, no, that's conflicts with the construction document. And I guess it's in the general provisions that we talk about. Oh, no, here it is. Section 14, dispute resolution as well. This current draft construction contract and dispute resolution calls for binding arbitration. And so that's one where legal counsel and I have gone back and forth, you know, thinking about, is this a good approach to have binding arbitration or not? And we're going to talk about it some more, too, before we bring the contracts back for final approval. But right now what we're focused in are our standard documents under the informal bidding that's allowed in the public contracts code. So right now informal bidding is at less than $175,000. On January 1st, it's going to go up to $200,000. And we're focusing there because the couple waterline replacement projects that we have coming up and the generator project all fall into those informal bidding procedures. And if they were larger dollar volumes, we would not recommend binding arbitration. We would seek, you know, final resolutions of disputes would be with the courts. But in our discussion on these smaller dollar volume ones, maybe it's okay. And by taking this approach, we do avoid some other requirements of the Public Contracts Code, although those other requirements aren't like big hurdles or anything. So the trade-off there is, do we want to go through ultimate resolution through the courts or through a binding arbitration? And I don't know, Jeff, if you want to speak to that at all.
Well, in looking at it generally, I don't like binding arbitration provisions with public entities for the most part. And the same reason I also don't like attorney's fees provisions with public agencies, because you always have the ability to pay and your ability to collect money out of somebody else is limited, just because usually the person that you're going after doesn't have anything, but you can always shuffle money around to pay somebody. And so I get concerned attorney's fees encourage people to sue. Some provisions encourage people to sue agencies sometimes. But then in this case, the arbitration provision, I'm still looking at it. When I looked at it and we talked about it last week, it appeared that if we don't go this route, we're going to go through the Public Contracts Code and likely be in binding arbitration anyway, with the ability to then appeal the arbitrator's ruling. And this just creates another step, and that's how things kind of tend to drag on and on. There is the other side of this, and where it may be entirely appropriate here, is that as a public entity, you tend to work with parties through these problems pretty well. It doesn't become a big emotional issue that sometimes happens with construction among individuals and, you know, for private residences and things like that, where people get lost in the weeds. For the most part, you're hiring qualified, well-vetted contractors who will, and reasonable minds can find solutions. So that's all I have to say on it.
And that's all I have to say on the construction contract table of contents. The general conditions, that document is a lot more detail-oriented. Overall, there's 13 different articles, and I've just got a slide on each one. Briefly, so general provisions have, you know, standard definitions. Ownership and use of the documents, we always claim ownership of design. Architects and engineers as intellectual property usually want to maintain ownership of designs, but public agencies don't allow them to do that. Interpretation of contract documents often has the hierarchy. If the plans say one thing and the written technical specifications say another thing, which document takes precedence? And so this section will normally, we'll get into that. And generally speaking, it's the written specifications that will take precedence over plans.
Yeah.
A little bit about the district and, you know, making sure that contractors have access to project sites and, you know, our authority to implement whatever it is that we want to implement, some of the standards. Now, we have lots of, again, responsibilities of the contractor, right? So this is the fine print on the PowerPoint, and it's the fine print in the document, too, because Article 3 on contractor obligations is really the most extensive portion of the contract. Administration, what's the role of the district? What's the role of the design consultant? What's the role of the construction manager? There's only one contractor, but there's often multiple parties that are representing the district. You know, the general manager, who designed it, who's the construction manager. Often agencies will, in hiring a design consultant and a construction manager, who is responsible on the job? And so, do we want the design consultant to also be the construction manager or not? One of the points of having an independent construction manager is that if you have a conflict or a dispute that happens in construction, if the construction manager is independent, then the theory is they have a better ability to come back to us and say it's the designer's problem or it's the contractor's problem. If you use a designer to also do the construction management, then you know, it's not fair to say that the designer is always going to say it's the contractor's problem, but there's an inherent conflict of interest for the designer to also be the construction manager. And historically, my position has always been it depends on the size of the project. So in larger projects, I like to see the independence of the construction manager. But on smaller projects, if you have an independent construction manager, then they're going through the learning curve and they're relearning the whole project. And having that independence on a small project may not be worth the additional cost that you're paying to have an independent construction manager. And it also gets into the complexities of the work. So when we're talking about basic water line replacements or sewer line replacements, we're not talking about complexity of construction like water treatment plants or rebuilding a dam. And so you'll see most likely on small dollar, projects that are not complex, my recommendations would be is the design consultant will be also the construction manager. Sometimes if we're working in Caltrans right away, they don't allow it. They'll require us to have a separate construction manager. So again, general provisions will state one thing, and then special provisions, we can modify it on a case-by-case basis. And then administration of contract. There's lots of language about claims because it's the records, recording it, documentation of claims, and we have to be really stringent with contractors on making sure they're documenting their claims, they're sending them to the right person. There's no, I sent you an email 6 weeks ago. You should have known that was a claim. And that's one of the ones where, again, conferences, that's the ABC of coaching on these things is to really require the contractors to follow through on a good documented process if they're going to assert claims. Article 5 is the relationship with subcontracts and subcontractors. And essentially, in case the prime contractor fails, we always have a contingent assignment where we can start working with the subcontractors if necessary. Article 6 talks about when we do work or when we have separate contracts for some of the construction work. And it's likely we're not going to run into that a whole bunch. The county on Air Park Drive Bridge, though, where they have their contractor who's the bridge contractor, and then they've got us who's doing separate work, it's a little bit more relevant because the coordination of activities will come into play. And then ultimately, we have a right to clean up a mess of a contractor if they're not cleaning it up and make them pay if that's what we have to do. Changes, this is the same as claims in a way, not exactly, but sometimes changes are agreed upon. When they're not, they become claims. But again, this process of what type of documentation do we need, change orders, change order requests, field orders, and then disputes regarding changes. So processes are really important to make sure that they're articulated so everybody knows what needs to be done. Contract time. There's some details in here that are interesting. For example, we might give a contractor 45 days to get a job done. That really is only a 15-day job. And in those situations, we're being liberal on their timing in the hope then that we'll get better bids. Because if they can work our project into other projects that they're working on and we give them flexibility, we might get a good price on it. But the key here is if you give them 45 days, and they only think it takes 15 days. It should only take them 15 days, and it takes them 20 days. It took them 5 days longer than they asked, than they thought it should take us, but far less than what we give them. They can still file a delay claim with us if we're not careful. And the idea being is that, hey, it should have only taken me 15 days, and the district, you guys did this and that and the other thing, and you made it took me 5 days longer than it should have taken. And so they want money for that delay claim. So contract time is really important to specify details on there. Like, no, you don't own that additional time. That additional time is called float. So if you have float in a contract, you don't own it. You don't get to come after us for it. And then you get into other things. Like, let's say that there is a delay and that was their fault, and then there's a delay that's our fault. And are they concurrent, and how much additional time do they get? So this Article 8 speaks to those kinds of details And that was one of the areas where I thought that Santa Monica wrote it up better than I had seen it in other situations. But time is money, so that's an important provision. Article 9, you know, that's all about getting paid, both retentions and withholding money. And if a contractor wants to have the retention put into a financial institution so that they can manage the investments, they have the right to do that. So how does that work? That's in there. Beneficial occupancy is essentially the project doesn't have to be done before we can start using it. Maybe it's a phased project. Even if we have beneficial occupancy for a portion of the project, doesn't mean that we've approved the entirety of the project. And then we get into substantial completion, which includes punch ticket items. When do we give them punch tickets, the punch list, and then what do we do about signing off?
What's a punch list?
So a punch list is like on substantial completion. It's where you just walk around and you say, if it was a building or a room like this, that paint over in that corner was too sloppy. You need to clean it up. So the project's, you know, substantially complete, but there's still all those little odds and ends, and so we have to go and document the odds and ends. It's almost even like when renters are about to move out of a place, you know, the landlord goes in there and says, well, if you don't clean this up, then I'm going to, you know, dock your deposit or whatever.
Thank you. Yeah.
The doorknobs aren't on the doors.
Yep, need to have doorknobs on.
And there's certain legal implications, too, as to substantial implication as far as triggering timelines for filing notices or when rights of parties to sue begin. And it's often on substantial completion because they disregard those little punch list items to determine that sort of thing.
Article 10 is about safety. Putting, you know, the contractor is, what we call it is that the contractor controls the site. And anything on that site, they are ultimately responsible for all the safety on that site. And so here, you know, this is how we contractually bind them to safety. Insurance and bonds, we talked about that a little bit earlier, and it's almost a reiteration here. Defective work, what are we going to do about making them correct their defective work? And then there's, this outline doesn't show it, there's this what's called a difference between patent or patent defects or latent defects. And so patent defects are the ones that are reasonably identifiable during an inspection or an observation of the work. And essentially, when we sign off on the project, that means all of those things that we should have been able to identify during observation or inspection, that we've basically given the okay on it. But especially in things like waterline projects and things that are underground, there can be a defect that there's just no way we're going to be able to notice it during an inspection. And so those are the latent defects. And so we want to make sure that we hold the contractor responsible for those latent defects. Basically, we want to hold them responsible for all time. But there is a, you know, limitation of pipes will leak after a certain while. And so we have an obligation to show that if we found a subsequent problem after the contract is all done, that in fact it was a latent defect. And they'll come back and they'll say, no, it wasn't. And then, you know, you get into the court thing and maybe barring arbitration or, you know, usually these things end in settlements. And then Article 13, statutory requirements. And so both state and federal laws have different versions of non-discrimination equal opportunity. That's actually something that I think also comes up in the ethics training or board training. Differences between federal and state laws on non-discrimination equal opportunity. And then we've got a lot of state labor laws and prevailing wage, payroll record requirements, reiteration of a lot of the requirements on work days. Basically, obligating the contractor to make sure that they're complying with all of those laws. And then, again, these are the general provisions. So in special provisions is where we will start incorporating the federal requirements if we have a federally funded job.
Could I ask a question?
Yes.
Because I thought I... Discrimination, local custom and habit. What are those? I mean, I understand all the rest of them.
Which...
Discriminate on the basis of local custom or habit. It's listed under 13.1.3. Contractors agree not discriminate against... I just don't know what local custom would be or what habit would be.
Thirteen point one point three,
right at the fourth paragraph. Point one.
Page 86.
Yeah.
13.1.3. I think it's just covering habit.
Yeah, but what is it?
Discrimination.
Local customer habit.
Like maybe a practice that's discriminatory, habit, habitually,
something that's been
that you
done,
don't think of it as being because you've always practiced it. Like,
yeah.
That's what I would think. Like just
implicit
because
bias
the custom
type of thing.
In that area was to do it a certain way and you can't do it just because it was.
Well, I have a guess, but we'll double check.
No, I just,
you read your package.
Yeah, well, I just... Local custom could be like if everybody in Oceana said, I suppose it's a Latino town, we'll only hire Latinos, would be... It's not really racist.
So
I mean,
what I'm thinking is that Santa Monica is a charter city, and they have their own... prevailing wage. They have a living wage ordinance.
Yeah.
And they also have, the living wage ordinance is the one that comes to mind really quickly. They have a couple other types of ordinances through. So a charter city as opposed to a general law city can write some of their own rules or write some of their more flexibility. So a living wage ordinance and another one that I can't remember right now. And what I'm sort of speculating here is that local custom is tying back to some of the requirements in their charter. And so what we'll do is we'll look at this because what we really want it to do is reflect California law.
Yeah, I know. It baffles me that, I mean, it looks like all the rest of them cover all the issues that local custom or habit would.
Right. And you know. And we know that, you know, we can pull up California law and make sure that states that.
Well,
so that's
I see no problem in having the on in there, the fact that we don't know what it means, you know. I mean, it obviously protects somebody from something.
Yeah.
I mean, from discrimination in some way. So it's good. It's not bad. But anyway, thank you for confusing me. Yeah.
And so next step, final review and approval. So what we encourage is that if you are reading through this late at night and you find another observation like that one that President White just brought up, then let us know and we'll work on it. But I think they're in pretty good form. We're still going to do a final review. We're going to talk about binding arbitration a little bit more. And then my goal would be to come back at either the next meeting or the second meeting in October for final approval with the direction to proceed on bidding for the generator project.
I have a suggestion now. As I mentioned at the last meeting, the California Supreme Court has ruled that shell can mean may, and I noticed there are a lot of shells in here, so I would suggest changing shell to
must
or will or may, so, whatever's appropriate and not ambiguous.
And I recall you mentioning that last time, but so your recollection, it's the California Supreme Court as opposed to the U.S. Supreme Court?
Right.
Okay. We'll look into that as well.
I have a question. In the smaller contracts, the ones under 200,000 starting, wouldn't binding arbitration there's less money and you would spend less lawyer fees probably? Is that one of the guiding things? And it's just, I'm thinking.
Yes, that is the idea generally about arbitration, is that it provides an informal way to resolve it so that instead of you waive your right to have a trial by a jury, you can still have discovery like you normally would, depositions, all those aspects of a trial. But instead of going to a judge and a jury, you would have a designated arbitrator who would swear in witnesses and hear testimony in usually a conference room, and still then provide a opinion.
Yeah.
So the idea is that it would save money. The amount of money it actually saves in practice is pretty minimal when you get that far, because all the money is spent in the discovery phase where you're going through all those depositions and reviewing documents and all these things. So I've gone through arbitrations where at the end of it I would have said we could have done this as a bench trial before a judge, and it would have been just as efficient. So,
okay, yeah, that's
The idea.
Yeah, and yes. You still don't. Either way, you're not going to be happy with the settlement.
You know, the other thing with arbitration that is interesting is that arbitrators have more discretion often than sitting Superior Court judges, as far as they have leeway to make rulings and findings in a little looser of a manner than a Superior Court judge would.
Yeah. You can lose easier.
My understanding is in binding arbitration cases involving consumers, they tend to be biased towards the companies. The consumers often lose. Is there any similar bias regarding public agency contractual matters of this type? Or to one side or the other that you're aware of?
No, I'm not aware of that. I'm not aware of that, but there is instances like that. I mean, generally, is a general comment on how the implementation of law goes. The law usually favors tenants over landlords. It usually favors employees over employers, mm-hmm. And just as a matter of course in certain things, whether it would... I don't see any avenue other than the bias of a particular arbitrator where a contractor, you know, of course it could be deemed as the little guy versus the big government, you know, that's always a concern, I guess. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Anything else? Okay, let's move on to item 9D, update on the five cities. Excuse me. Update on the Five Cities Fire Authority Joint Powers of Authority Agreement and the County CAL FIRE Strategic Plan efforts, and provide the board direction as deemed appropriate. Mr. Ogren, sir.
Madam President, members of the board, on the update on Five Cities Fire Authority, when my most recent meeting with the two city managers and Chief Lieberman was last Friday, and I did get a question on this board direction as deemed appropriate. They were maybe a little bit concerned we were going to start heading in a certain direction before the discussions were all done. And so I ensured them that I put that on many agenda items to give your board the flexibility of providing direction, though I'm not really anticipating any specific direction tonight. What I want to do is provide an update on both the status of the discussions internal to Five Cities Fire Authority and the other agencies, and also the meeting with the county on their efforts for updating the CAL FIRE, County Fire Strategic Plan specifically for special districts. And that's where I'd like to start. I feel that both dialogues, both meetings, have been productive. And these are really large maps, so our computer's ability to work through them all. It's a little bit of a challenge. These are CAD drawings and usually require very powerful computers. We've converted them to PDF files and then even done what's called a shrinking the PDF file. And this is the first one is Exhibit A. And so in talking about the CAL FIRE, County FIRE approach, right now what their team is doing is just purely factual-based understanding of five different communities, unincorporated communities in the county. Those are Oceano, Cambria, San Miguel, Templeton, and Santa Margarita. And the approach is one that one of the other agencies called me and he felt uncomfortable with. But the idea is they're basically saying, what's the county going to do if any of these fire departments fail? And one of the other CSD managers was like, well, I'd like them to hear how they can support us. And I said, well, yeah, that's a little bit of county talk, I guess. But what they're doing is they indicated there's four different models that they're evaluating for fire departments in unincorporated communities. And on each community then, what's the most likely model that would be implemented? And I guess it's in the event that, you know, the local agency was no longer able to move forward, then what would the options be for the county? And so that report is due out in about mid-November, and we'll certainly have a chance to review it, and we'll see what kind of information that they do. But they are, again, they're not developing recommendations for the Board of Supervisors. They're just doing an evaluation of facts and then some comparison to different models that are out there. So that's a little bit of the background, and then they produce these following maps for us. The first one that we have on the screen, and then there's a hard copy on the wall, and board members should have hard copies for each of you as well, Exhibit A. And this map illustrates the responses in Oceano. So it's both with respect to location and then frequency. And so we see some of the areas, let's say right down in here on Highway 1, where the purple gets pretty, it's a brighter purple. And then there's other areas that have brighter purple too. So that this indicates that there's a lot more calls in those particular areas. And then in some of the areas, let's say this is Elm Street right here, and off of Elm Street where we have a lot of more of the single family residential, we don't get as many calls in there, or Five Cities Fire doesn't get as many calls. So I forget what the name of this, but it shows locations and frequency of calls, and we can see where Five Cities Fire Authority is responding within the community of Oceano. And then the next several slides, what they do is they show CAL FIRE's evaluation of what are the response times in Oceano depending on what station is responding. So Exhibit B, and I think all the board members should have each of these labeled for you. And so this is assuming that CAL FIRE station number 22 is responding from Napomo. And the different colors indicate the different response times. So the green, which is, you know, usually indicated as good, provides a response time in 0 to 7 minutes. If it's blue, then the response time is 7 to 8 minutes. And if it's yellow, that's 8 to 15 minutes. And I believe that includes an assumed 3 minutes from the time that the call is made until the firefighters and their emergency responders are actually, you know, dressed in the engine on and ready to get out the door. So that's basically a 3-minute standard. And so then in the green, it means another 4 minutes to get there. And so obviously all the green is up, you know, near Napomo because this is responding from the station, and all responses to Oceano from that County Cal Fire Station is going to put us in 8 to 15 minutes. And we don't know if it's 8 minutes and 1 second or if it's 15 minutes. But we can see that right at Highway 1 and Halcyon is the tip of the blue. So that means that they're getting there in 7 to 8 minutes. If we're out in the northwestern part of Oceano, you can bet it's, you know, probably 3 or 4 more minutes to get over there, maybe not quite that. But if you're in the Halcyon area, it's just going to be a hair over 8 minutes because they're already there from the Cal Fire Station in Napomo. And what the County Cal Fire guys are doing, of course, is trying to see what are response times, because it's really getting to those emergencies in a timely manner that saves lives. The second one then that they developed is Exhibit C. And the stations that would or could be responding there essentially are any of the stations other than Oceano. So, and not Rio Grande either. So Grover, the Cal Fire Station in Napomo, the Cal Fire Station in Pismo. Oh, yes, and also the Rio Grande Station.
Yeah.
And what Exhibit B shows us, and this is probably the most, to me, this is the most significant of all the exhibits, because it's the one that assumes that Oceano Station is shut down. That it just doesn't, you know, and so anybody's responding to Oceano. And on the screen, it's a little bit hard because I'm, again, the power of this computer doesn't allow me to blow it up very well. But what we see in the middle of Oceano is a yellow area. And that means that, and that's right off of Elm Street. It's also sort of in that area where we don't get as many calls, but that's at least not over the last 3 to 5 years. It can always change. But when blue surrounds it, it means that the responders are getting there in 7 to 8 minutes. And we know, you know, the distance of time from any of those blue areas within the Elm Street corridor isn't going to take them much longer. You know, what is it, 15 seconds longer, 40 seconds longer? So even though it's yellow, we know that that's just barely over 8 minutes to get into the middle part. And then, of course, the Grover Station is going to be responding in less than 7 minutes in some areas of town, but a lot of the community would really be in a 7 to 8 minute response time. And most of those responses are assuming that the Grover Station has been dispatched. So again, Exhibit B or Exhibit C here is the one that I think most illustrates what the community could anticipate in the event that Oceano no longer had a responding station, which, of course, is what we want to avoid. Exhibit D, with everything looking good and green, means that that's the Oceano station response. And so, not surprisingly, all incidences within Oceano from the Oceano station can be responded to in less than 7 minutes. It also shows that there's a significant area of Grover Beach that the Oceano station responds to in less than 7 minutes, and even portions of Rio Grande that we can respond to in less than 7 minutes. The analysis didn't get to the finer detail, but it would appear that we can respond to Rio Grande properties in less than 7 minutes, but the Rio Grande station cannot respond to Oceano in less than 7 minutes.
Yeah, certainly I was looking at Halcyon, and the only time you see green on Halcyon is when it's Oceano. And you'd think a Rio Grande could get there. And it,
quicker. And
it doesn't show that they can. That whole corridor of Halcyon Road is kind of in no man's land until you have Oceano Station.
Yeah. Our next illustration, then, is Exhibit E. And Exhibit E illustrates response from the CAL FIRE station in Pismo. And so that appears to even be a little bit slower than the CAL FIRE station in Napomo. Because if you remember from the first exhibit, the CAL station in Napomo can get to the corner of Highway 1 and Halcyon in right about 8 minutes. But we don't really see the Pismo station getting there, except for right there where our border of Grover is. And, of course, a lot of that is state parks territory. And so I guess there's probably not a lot of difference between the Pismo station and the Napomo station, but it would still seem like the Napomo station would be a little bit quicker. And so these are the different response times that we're showing and that the county and CAL FIRE. One of the things that was nice about it is that during the discussions with Five Cities Fire, Chief Lieberman was talking about running these models himself. But when we met with CAL FIRE, they had already done so. And they're especially important down the road in the future. You know, your board previously had deferred consideration of a special tax election until June of 2020. These are the types of illustrations in the maps that can really help the community understand what are the different response times from the different stations and important information when it comes to community-based decisions like special taxes. In reference to response times with Five Cities Fire Authority discussions themselves with the city managers and Chief Lieberman, there's a couple of things that I think are really important that I'm glad that we've been able to get to in those discussions. Because a lot of the overall discussions have been about funding formulas. And one of my concerns is we had lost sight of cost controls. And so as we're proceeding with talking about the different funding formulas and how much one of the, you know, how much should Rio Grande pay, how much should Grover pay, how much should Oceano pay for Five Cities Fire Authority, we can't lose sight of the idea that, well, it's not just how much we share in the cost or what percentage we pay, but it's also how do we control overall costs and how do we make sure we're getting the best services for the three communities. And so we've had a little bit of discussion of, well, what if, based on cost controls, we had to go to a two-station department? And one of the quick things that we all recognize is that it's really cost of labor. It's not the stations themselves. It's the labor of a fire department that drives our costs. So would we really even save much money by closing a station? And the answer is, well, that's going to depend on how does it affect staffing levels. So Chief Lieberman and Debbie Malicote, who's the administrative support from the city of Rio Grande, they're going to look at other types of potential cost savings measures. And in a nutshell, what that really means is that we're turning over all the stones that we can, all the rocks that we can, in order to try to address what's the best future of Five Cities Fire Authority. I don't think anybody is really very optimistic about having a two-station department, and it would create other types of complications as well. But when we have to address cost controls, then I'm glad that at least we're looking at those types of issues. Even the idea that if it was two stations that are responding to fire, what about if the Oceano station was just responding to medical emergencies? Because certainly that's the highest volume of calls. Is there an approach there that might help with overall cost controls? But again, if we talk about cost controls, we have to talk about them in context of service levels. And so these maps and response times are one of the best indicators of service level. And that's a little bit of a lead into some of the figures that Chief Lieberman has been providing us. And I'm not going to get too much into this particular slide, because what it does is it just speaks to some of the factors that are already involved in our cost-sharing formulas, population, assessed value, staffing levels, and services. Those are the four components to our existing funding formula. And so those are the components that we're looking at in terms of what might be possible funding formula modifications. And speaking about possible funding formula modifications, I want to speak appreciation for Matt Bronson, who's the city manager for Grover Beach, because he's been running numerous different scenarios, and that's been pretty helpful for us to look at those that just aren't going to work and others that, you know, the idea of trying to focus in on a few that we can bring back to decision makers, the elected officials. But I did want to touch on this particular slide, and again, kind of hard to read, and it's in the agenda package. But what it does is it, and this really kind of jumped out at me, is it provides a benchmark for what about Five Cities Fire Authority in comparison to other fire departments. And part of it is, you know, it is election season, so we're hearing things coming out of different communities and different candidates who are running for office. And I try to keep my ear to the railroad tracks. And I've been hearing things that seemed like they were either like taking shots at Five Cities Fire Authority, as if the Five Cities Fire Authority is itself creating big budget problems for some of the other agencies. And I just don't think that that's factually correct. I don't think that anybody can make an argument that the Five Cities Fire Authority itself is creating financial hardship to any of the three communities. And I base that on these per capita numbers. If we look at the cost of Five Cities Fire Authority on a per capita basis in comparison to other fire departments, they're really just, I think it illustrates how well Five Cities Fire Authority is doing. Now, we know these numbers will go up as the strategic plan is being implemented, but that's also then why we have to address cost controls. So you can't see them anymore in there, but Five Cities Fire Authority is running at about $138 per capita. That covers both Arroyo Grande and Grover Beach as far as cities go. And Arroyo Grande is a little bit more than $140 per capita, and Grover Beach is a little bit under $135 per capita, and Oceano is right in the middle at about $137 or $138 per capita. The next least expensive city is Atascadero, and they're running at $138 per capita. After that, you jump up to Paso Robles, which is just under $200 per capita. You move into San Luis Obispo and Morro Bay, which are just south of $250 per capita to just north of $250 per capita. And then you move into Pismo Beach, which is about $354 per capita. Cambria CSD is at $376 per capita. And it doesn't list all the unincorporated areas. But when we just compare it to the cities, the cost per capita for Five Cities Fire Authority is really, really pretty good. The cost per capita comparisons only go so far, because we know that it makes sense that the city of Pismo Beach's cost per capita is so high. They've got a population that's essentially the same as Oceano, but they have a lot of hotels and they have a lot more homes. You know, the average occupancy in Pismo Beach is less than the average occupancy in Oceano. So they have a bigger territory to cover. They have more responsibilities. The hotels and the taxes means that they also have a better revenue stream to pay for their fire department. So the cost per capita numbers can only go so far. But when you're looking at a community, a combined community of Arroyo Grande, Grover, and Oceano, where we have three stations and we're keeping that cost per capita down, that's a pretty good sign. Now, at what next work that the managers that we have to do is take these numbers and say, okay, over the period of time that the strategic plan is being implemented, how will these numbers change? Including this, though, there's another statistic. I only right now I'm showing something that Chief Lieberman's providing. That's just kind of a protocol thing with the city managers. If they're producing work, then I'm not going to show it. But City Manager Bergman did run some other calculations, and he said coverage area per station. So where the Atascadero is about the same cost per capita as Five Cities Fire Authority is, for all practical purposes, they're the same. The difference is in Five Cities Fire Authority, it's just over 3 square miles per station of coverage. And so the total is roughly 10 square miles, 3 stations, you know, just over 3 square miles per station. In Atascadero, they have 2 stations, and each station has to cover over 13 square miles. So even though the Atascadero cost per capita is about the same as Five Cities Fire Authority, their coverage territory for each station is much, much larger. Another type of evidence that what we're all getting from Five Cities Fire Authority is good, and all 3 communities are getting good deals from Five Cities Fire Authority. So I wanted to make sure to share that because that's, you know, part of the evaluation that the managers that we're going through. And we have heard a little bit of the political rhetoric that seems to be slamming on Five Cities Fire Authority, or maybe even Oceano's participation. And yet when we look at actual evidence, everything points to the fact that Five Cities Fire Authority is a really effective fire department for the 3 communities. So next steps that we'll be taking is, again, I mentioned that Matt Bronson with the City of Grover Beach had identified a number of different scenarios that we've been looking at, trying to focus in on a couple that we think would be really good to bring back to the elected officials, decision makers. Jim Bergman had been running some statistics, and I agreed to take it to the next level because the challenge that we have right now is cost controls. We know that the City of Arroyo Grande has indicated that if their costs go up too high, then it might be more feasible for them just to run their own department. And, of course, the concern would be how might that impact service levels both to Arroyo Grande as well as the rest of the 3 communities. But they have some cost control concerns, and those are legitimate. Likewise, we know that our funding is fixed based on property taxes, and even though property taxes go up every year, it still takes about 95% of our property taxes to fund Five Cities Fire Authority, with a little bit that we spend on revenue. So we have a funding cap, and then the idea is, well, what might it be with a special tax? And again, through these dialogues, including feedback from the fire chiefs and county fire, is that the general opinion out there that I've been hearing is that if you're asking for more than about $100 per year, or maybe $10 a month, which works out to about $120 a year, if you're really asking for a single-family home to pay much more than that, the likelihood of not getting a special tax approved increases really fast. And I think that bears, we saw, you know, I followed 8 or 9 special tax elections for fire departments this year. All but one got at least 50% approval, but we need 2/3 approval. Only about 3 out of the 8 got it. There was one that actually had a huge fire tax approved for over $600 a year, but it was a subdivision that had maybe 40 homes in it. So, you know, that was a special case, and obviously those residents and property owners, you know, they all got together and realized what they needed to do. But again, the idea that if seeking a special tax is going to be more than about $100 per year, about more than $10 a month, the likelihood of passage starts dropping pretty quickly. And so that creates, you know, a cost control for Oceano as well. So we know Arroyo Grande has expressed cost control concerns. We know that there's ultimately going to be funding limitations on Oceano's ability. So my next step is to take some of the analysis that Matt Bronson has done And then just taking it to the next level and incorporating some cost controls into that evaluation, and then see where we're at, and then compare those budgets to what future year's strategic planning budgets would look like. And then that's where Chief Lieberman and Debbie Malicott will say, okay, if we have different levels of budgets to work with, then what, you know, how might it work for Five Cities Fire Authority? So those different, you know, dynamics that are moving on are moving forward. I really appreciated the response time analysis from the county and CAL FIRE. And we have a lot of different balls in the air right now as we're moving forward, but they're going good. And then, oh, there's one more. Do I even have that one up?
I think you have it somewhere.
Tax break.
Yeah. That was mostly for my own...
Such a pretty colored map.
Pleasure. Yeah. So on the wall, we have this pretty colored map of Oceano. And what it is, it's called a tax rate area map. And what it does is that it shows out of... Okay, so property taxes in California, we basically pay 1% of our assessed value. Our assessed value is based on what did we buy for our piece of property, and it can go up 2% per year. And that's the beauty of Prop 13, is that when we buy a house, we know that our property taxes are relatively fixed unless we vote to increase them. Mm-hmm. Well, you dive into the details, and how much of those property taxes does Oceano get from any particular property owner? And it could depend on what block you live in. And so these tax rate areas have existed forever. But what they do is they break Oceano into different areas depending on what taxing jurisdictions you live in. So if you live by Rio Grande Creek, you're going to be part of County Flood Control Zone 1 and 1A. But if you live up by the Pike, you're not going to be part of County Flood Control Zone 1 and 1A. So you have different taxing jurisdictions that affect your property, and so you're in different tax rate areas. And what the county did provide is for each of these taxing areas, and let's just say they're different in each neighborhood in Oceano, we know what percentage of the property taxes comes to Oceano and what percentage comes to the county. Overall, in Oceano, we get about 14% of the property taxes that are generated. The county gets about 21% of the property taxes, which, considering the responsibilities of the county, really is not a large percentage in comparison to what Oceano gets. So for those of us who kind of like to get into those numbers and understand some fine details, those are great things to look at.
Schools get 50%?
The schools, yeah, they don't necessarily get perfectly 50%,
but
they get the lion's share of the property tax revenues now. And that kind of addresses my point, is that the split in the percentages was based on when Proposition 13 was passed in 1976, so that if Oceano had 14% of the tax revenues at that time, then after Proposition 13, we get 14% of the pie. Proposition 13 made the pie smaller, but we still get the same percentage. And those percentages will slightly change from year to year, because if property values in one neighborhood go up faster than they are in another neighborhood, it'll affect how much money we get. You know, that those taxing percentages stay the same, but if Oceano's property values went up faster than another community's, then our overall percentage would go up a little bit. Tend to be pretty nominal changes. But the importance of understanding this is that in the early 2000s, the state basically took tax revenues away from counties, cities, and special districts, and they transferred them to school districts, and it's called the Educational Relief Augmentation Fund, Educational Recovery Augmentation Fund, ERAF. But subsequently, this hit on property taxes. Proposition 172 was passed, and it was where the state gave some of their state sales taxes back to counties and cities to make up for the property taxes that had been taken away. Well, those sales taxes and being given back to the counties and cities were never given to special districts. So special districts like Oceano, we lost tax revenues with the educational, with ERAF, but we never got backfilled from any of the sales taxes because those only went to counties and cities. And I guess the only exception was maybe Monterey County had some money that went to some of their special districts. The point is that I'm going to endeavor to see if I can do a calculation on how much property taxes we would have today annually. We collect about $1 million a year in property taxes. How much would we have if ERAF had never been implemented? That is a relatively easy calculation to do. The calculation of how much did the county benefit from Prop 172 sales tax increases, that might be a lot more difficult because, again, that countywide. County CAL FIRE people did, though, show us that, you know, the amount of sales taxes generated in Oceano were, really nominal. But, again, it's an issue of equity. We lost property taxes, and then when the state recovered from that run recession, they backfilled counties and cities on sales taxes. And it's the only argument that I can think of right now as to, you know, why should the county help us out? And it's, the answer is, well, because you got Prop 172 to help backfill for your property tax losses, but we were never backfilled. And there's a number of inequities associated with the property tax system and sales taxes. For example, Napomo Community Services District has no fire responsibilities. They have no general governmental services, but they do get property taxes for their enterprise funds, their water and sewer funds. And again, that's a function of Proposition 13. These tax calculations are interesting. They may not have any influence at the end of the day because the county still needs to balance its budget. But, you know, again, it never hurts to put issues on the table. And they are also, obviously, like Grover, looking at some other revenue enhancements. I should be careful. Grover Beach has consciously pursued cannabis revenues. I'm not sure that the county has been as conscious about pursuing cannabis revenues. I think there's probably a little bit different philosophy at the county board as compared to Grover. But no matter how you get there, the county is still looking at potential revenues from cannabis. And as a new revenue source, if that hasn't been dedicated to any expenditure sources in the county, then maybe there's an opportunity to get a little bit of revenue enhancement there.
And they're putting it here.
Pardon me?
And they're putting the storage places here.
Yeah. And here's the important point here when we look at these different issues. We have to maintain a focus on Five Cities Fire Authority. We have to maintain a focus on the funding formulas and on cost controls. And so we will be doing the analysis of what might the Five Cities Fire Authority budget look like and the different funding formulas. Understanding Rio Grande has some cost controls that they have to have addressed. Understanding that we have revenue limitations of our property taxes and a potential special tax. And when we look at all that stuff, and if it's all really close, that might give us an avenue to appeal to the county for some support. But again, these are the different things that we're looking at. It would be way too premature to draw any conclusions of where we're going to be at in a couple more months. I think that it would be fair, though, that as the managers are getting closer and closer to recommendations, that we might be recommending a joint meeting of your board with the City Council of Grover and the City Council of Rio Grande, because staff can only go so far. We can develop joint recommendations, but the idea that I come back and I make recommendations to your board and that's kind of isolated from City Manager Bergman going back to Rio Grande making recommendations to his board and Bronson making recommendations to Grover City Council. Those three things going on independently can create challenges to finding a resolution at the end of the day. And if the three managers are pretty close on some recommendations, we might find it beneficial to have the three agencies together, formally under Brown Act with the independent ability to act. And it might be beneficial for the three managers to do a joint presentation to all three agencies as to where we've arrived. So I think that's, you know, probably the best I can do in summarizing where we've been and the work that the county and CAL FIRE have brought in and some of the dynamics. But again, you know, it's election season and we hear the little things that are said sometimes, and I think all the evidence indicates that Five Cities Fire is a pretty cost-effective operation. You know, 3 square miles per station is great coverage territory. I guess that means the burden is on the managers to come up with some good recommendations in the coming months.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Questions? Comments from the board?
I just think that it's going to, these response times are the key to what, to get the people in Oceano and the, everywhere to know how important it is to keep the Five Cities Fire Authority
keep
working,
keep
together,
the Oceano keep, Station
keep
open.
Keep the Oceano yes. Station open. Because,
yeah,
I mean,
well,
it's pretty, it's right here what would happen if it didn't, and it wouldn't be good for,
and
for
the,
us.
And the rank and file fire guys say that's what they think should happen. I mean, the fire, the guy handling the hose, the guy driving the truck, because I've talked to them and asked them, and three stations. They just feel like that's their best way of really.
And I think that Paul's meetings with the other managers are going well.
Yeah.
So it's promising.
And 75% of the calls are medical.
And 1 minute seems like an hour.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've had them come to my home at least several times for my mother, and I was just amazed, and I was so thankful that they arrived in 5 minutes less. It seemed like less than 5 minutes, but they were there in 5 minutes, but I'm only across the street. So.
Yeah. Yes. Anyway, okay. Any hearing items? Moving on.
None.
Received written communication and late received written communication?
No, and just for clarification for our new board members, when I look, obviously I get a lot of emails and written communication. What I'm really focusing here on is those that I think are relevant for a future agenda item. You know, if something is coming up that it's, and I mentioned the one that we got the email and with the link to that recent court case on the county's public trust, the duties under the public trust doctrine for counties when issuing new well permits. So that was a recent piece of correspondence
yeah.
that, you know, I spoke to already.
I think future agenda items, I think we went over a lot of that at the last meeting.
Yeah, but I do want to kind of provide a little bit of indication of what I think is coming up pretty soon. So I did meet yesterday with the new executive director of One Cool Earth and anticipate that will be back on the agenda for October 10th. On the consent agenda for the 10th, we can anticipate the biannual review of the Conflict of Interest Code. We need to simply add the position of district engineer / assistant general manager. Also on the consent agenda, we have a technical correction nominal item for the SEIU MOU. Then in terms of business items, mentioned I want to address the Lopez and this appeals court and the relationship to the low reservoir response plan and contract amendments, and we'll be seeking board direction on some of that. The emergency generator seeking approval to proceed for design for the two replacement projects. I expect to have some proposals in. And landscaping easement, because the Highway 1 and the county's efforts for the revitalization, I think that needs to be, you know, back on the board's agenda as soon as I can get it. And then a request for proposals for the sewer system. capital improvements. There's been some discussions at the sanitation district. My word is, sounds like it's a little bit pithy, but still we've got the ball rolling, and Canon is far along on the evaluation of our water system replacements. I have received a technical memorandum from them, draft form, where they've prioritized our various projects and they've put a dollar amount to it. I cannot publicly disclose because they have to finish their quality control and their cost estimates. But they are far enough along that the water system capital improvements are well along, and we need to start thinking about lining up some firm to work on our sewer system side. So that's more than the number of items are going to be able to get on the next agenda. So some of them are going to roll over onto the October 24th meeting, which is also when then I would anticipate starting the discussion on board policies. So right now it's focusing in on capital projects, and by the latter part of October we'll be moving into board policy discussions.
Okay, thank you. Anything else to come before this board?
I move that we adjourn.
Second.
Meeting adjourned.